So Jesus didn't say that a person with wealth can't be saved, can't get to heaven, can't ever be found righteous enough to be acceptable. He did say a couple of clarifying things about it, though. And so for all who have a reasonably comfortable existence and maybe a dash extra, Jesus seems ready to disabuse us of a couple of notions. One, the idea that we do good because we're good. And two, the thought that doing enough good in the world to be considered righteous isn't particularly or overly demanding. You know, just generally, just be nice, and you're pretty much assured that you're on the right side, literally righteous, which means perfectly righteous, like Job, which is interesting since Job was written and included in the Bible as a fable and was never intended to be the authorized biography of an actual human being. Nobody this side of Jesus is perfectly righteous. So essentially, the good news of great joy, as proclaimed by the Christmas angels, rests on a couple of truths that are easily obscured. The good news is we're not good, and this isn't easy. Okay, have a great week. See you next Sunday. Thanks, preacher. As a matter of fact, for humans on their own, especially people of means, righteousness, Jesus says, is not possible. It probably doesn't sound to our ears like good news. But when we don't recognize those two truths, the real good news becomes meaningless to us. And when the real good news becomes meaningless to us, we become our own saviors. And when we count on our own selves to be both the source of and the judges of our own righteousness, the bar gets lowered even further, until eventually it becomes less and less clear to us why we should even care about, let alone do anything to help out anybody other than ourselves. And part of the tragedy of that is that all that potential that God brought into the world by making you part of it goes to waste, dies on the vine, rots in the soil. All of that potential healing and feeding and caring and bringing hope that God was so excited to bring into the world on the day you were born. But to realize that potential and to be faithful asks a lot of us. It takes work and conscience and faithfulness and loyalty to humankind as a whole and loyalty to your neighbor individually. It takes forgiveness and humility, and it isn't always easy. It's a long, long journey, and none of us can last long on that journey by ourselves. We rely to make that journey on the goodness and kindness of God and of others, to give us the strength and sustenance to carry on doing good, embodying Christ's love, feeding the world's hunger in all of its forms. Jesus said to that man with a lot of possessions, "No one is good but God alone." In other words, we don't create or manufacture goodness within us. God is the source of good. We are channels. Matter of fact, we're meant to be not just channels, but spigots of God's goodness into the world, wells of the water of life gushing up from underground springs, not of our own making. We don't do good because we're just so good that it just flows out of us naturally and we can't even help it. We have to choose it. Each of us is a complicated reality, like emotions. We're not intrinsically good. We're not intrinsically bad. We choose to do good or choose to do bad or just choose not to do as much good as we are capable of. And for all those who would choose to rack up a resume of good deeds and good works primarily in order to make a case for our own righteousness, to feel good about ourselves so we can sleep at night, well, it's kind of a good news, bad news situation. The bad news is, no matter how many accomplishments we string together in which the life chances of others are tangibly improved, it can still never be enough to make us righteous. The good news about that is, God doesn't demand that you become God in order to be found righteous. God simply demands that you become the best human you can be. For that reason, you can put aside for good the question of your own worthiness to claim your eternal reward. God takes care of all that. So all we have to worry about is doing as much good for the world as we can while we can. We choose to do good, or choose to do bad, or just choose not to do good. And followers of Christ are clearly and compellingly instructed to choose to do good. It's just that sometimes that is kind of a tall order. You may be familiar with the paradoxical commandments by Kent Keith. These were devised in the late 60s. Mother Teresa kept a version of this on her wall. Among the nuggets of wisdom in this little piece of writing, it says, people are illogical, unreasonable, and self-centered. Love them anyway. If you do good, people will accuse you of selfish, ulterior motives. Do good anyway. The good you do today will be forgotten tomorrow. Do good anyway. People favor underdogs, but follow only top dogs. Fight for a few underdogs anyway. People really need help, but may attack you if you do help them. Help people anyway. Give the world the best you have, and you'll get kicked in the teeth. Give the world the best you have anyway. Sometimes choosing to do good can be a pretty tall order. This is a long and demanding journey. Back in the Old Testament book of Joshua, during the time of the conquest of Canaan, when militarily the Israelites were on a roll and the surrounding peoples were rightly getting very nervous, some Gibeonites came to the Israelites' leader, Joshua. They told him that they'd been sent by the people of their country to take provisions for the journey and go meet the Israelites and say to them, "We are your servants. Come now, make a treaty with us." And to prove that they had traveled a long and grueling way to get there, they said to Joshua, look what's left of the bread that we brought. It was still warm when we took it from our houses as our food for the journey on the day we set out to come to you. But now look, it's dry and moldy. And these wineskins were new when we filled them, and see, they're burst. And these garments and sandals of ours are worn out from the very long journey. But it was all a ruse. The Gibeonites had been nearby all along and just wanted to be able to negotiate for favorable treatment by demonstrating how they had made such sacrifices to go on some long and grueling journey. The bread was already dry and moldy when they left the house. And they deliberately left in ratty clothes and these old wineskins. It can be tempting to try to find ways around having to undertake the real journey. It's tempting to manufacture evidence that we've already done more than our share. It's tempting to cut corners. It's tempting even to stand in front of the mirror and see if we can maybe even fool ourselves, if no one else, into believing that we've already given all that we have to give. Elijah, alone, running for his life, had left everything behind, even his personal servant. I mean, I came here today without my personal servant. I mean, it's talk about hardship. But he'd gone a full day's journey into the wilderness, and he found a broom tree as lonely and isolated as he was. And he sank down at the foot of it, probably curled up in a fetal position, and said to God, "Please just take me. I'm all but done for anyway." And as he drifted somewhere between sleep, delirium, hunger, and exhaustion, somebody tapped him. And he opened his eyes, and an angel, which is to say a messenger from God, said four words: "Get up and eat." And right by Elijah's head, he saw a jar of water. Close enough, he could reach out and feel its cool touch on his parched fingers. He felt warmth radiating from some heated stones on which he could smell a fresh cake of bread. The journey is long, and it's not easy. And no inherent goodness in Elijah made it any easier for him than it would be for you or for me. But God still had things for Elijah to do. A cup of water, a piece of fresh bread, a word of encouragement out of nowhere, and Elijah was able to carry on. Through hikers on the Appalachian Trail call it trail magic. Sometimes along the way, for no obvious reason and without specificity about the intended recipient, a tired, parched, emaciated, and footsore traveler making the hike from Springer Mountain in Georgia all the way up to the 100-mile wilderness in Mount Katahdin in Maine will find gifts or food or something cool to drink just sitting there along the trail. In towns along the way, like Hot Springs, you might even find somebody grilling food out in their yard just for the through hikers, for no other reason than pure hospitality. Those people doing that are probably what you and I would call good people. But what we really mean, according to Jesus, is that they are just people, like you and me, not organically good or bad, but who decided to do something good for somebody else, specifically for tired and hungry travelers, about whom all they know is that those travelers are in the midst of a long and demanding journey. In one of those stories that always reminds me to be wary anytime somebody advocates a return to biblical family values, Sarah had given, I put that word in quote marks, had given an Egyptian slave named Hagar to Sarah's husband, Abraham, for the purpose of procreation. For some reason, tensions arose when Hagar conceived and had a son by Abraham. Early one shameful morning, Hagar and the little boy were sent away with only some bread and a skin of water into the unforgiving wilderness of Beersheba. Water for the journey doesn't last very long, and when it ran out, the woman who, as a girl, had been taken so far from her home into slavery, impregnated, and then sent away with nothing but the boy she had carried, put him under a bush and went someplace else to cry, because she knew it was the end, and she couldn't bear to hear him crying his hungry, thirsty, final breaths before she drew her own. And as she cried tears of rage and bottomless sorrow into the abyss of what could only have felt like the most godforsaken circumstances, the voice of a messenger of God said, "Don't be afraid. I hear you. I can hear you both." And God opened her eyes, and now she could see a spring of water. And she refilled the skin and gave it to her son to drink. You can say the line you hear in the airplane about putting on your own oxygen mask first in the extremely unlikely event of a loss of pressure in the cabin, but every parent worthy of the name is going to make sure their child has food and water before they even think about the fact that they need to eat and drink too. It's a long, long journey, and it isn't easy. So when somebody offers a drink of water, in that moment, it's the most important thing in the world. One of Jesus' disciples told him they'd seen somebody casting out demons in Jesus' name, and they said they tried to stop him because it wasn't anybody they knew. It wasn't somebody on the team. There's a copyright infringement thing here at the very least. And Jesus said, don't stop him. He said, whoever is not against us is for us. Believe me when I say, whoever gives you a cup of water to drink because you bear the name of Christ will by no means lose the reward. The fact that everyone needs it, and that literally anyone may undertake the goodness of providing it, was made obvious when Jesus, a Jewish man, stopped midday in his journey and, breaking so many societal rules it's almost funny, asked a Samaritan woman for a drink from a Samaritan well. And it's only very soon after that episode of Jesus needing a drink of water from someone he wasn't supposed to ever ask for it. It's very soon after that episode in John's Gospel that a large crowd now had started following Jesus specifically because they had seen the signs that he was doing for the sick. The crowd members themselves may or may not have been sick, but they're following him because they've seen what he was doing for ailing people. He may be the last hope of those without financial resources who have at least one sick or suffering child, spouse, or parent. And the fact that, as John says, the crowd keeps following him would have to mean that it's people who have this much time available. In other words, there's no employment demanding their presence, and who are desperate enough to give this much commitment to such a desperate pursuit. And Jesus said to his disciple Philip, "Hey, Phil, where in the world or how on earth are we going to buy enough bread for these people to eat?" And Philip says more or less, "Well, I mean, we can't." And Jesus says, not with his words, but with his actions, "For mortals, it is impossible, but not for God. For God, all things are possible." And 5,000 desperate families on a long and draining journey receive even more than they can consume of compassion, encouragement, and food. "Ho, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters," says Isaiah. "And you that have no money, come, buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without price." This week, a small family gathering will take place wherein Kitty Peterson will be laid to rest and commended to God. We celebrated Kitty's 100th birthday not very long before hospice came in. But on that day, on that 100th birthday, there are people here who put that party together. There they are. She was as alive and wonderful as she was all the time. Every day of that century, Kitty Peterson chose to do good on a very, very long and grueling journey. The journey is long and demanding, wherein disciples serve the world around them with love and compassion. For that reason, God has compassion on us, and we get help along the way. Let us therefore approach the throne of grace with boldness, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need.